lodges I ride in this wind.
And there have been phases of breakout from government control. One person in government remarked to me that the laboratory's basic business plan is to substitute themselves for the government decision-making process, control all the information that could make it possible for government to reassert its authority, and to blackmail the government if any attempt is made to change either of the first two conditions. It goes beyond lobbying to simply replacement of government.
And you give me your bed.
The transition from public service to private enterprise and greed, as a previous generation might have called it, is both a tremendous danger, but it is also part of the opportunity that we have, because a weapons complex founded on greed and corporate profit is not a very functional weapons complex. The good news is that the system is in crisis.
You're listening to episode 709 of Unwelcome Guests, Facing the Failing Culture of Control, Part 2, Atoms for Profit. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard a few thoughts from Greg Mello, from whom we shall hear more later. Last time we looked at the problems for individuals when society decides certain behavior patterns and thoughts are bad, certain ones are good, and the bad ones should be abolished by the most effective means possible. Well, we're going to look this time at what happens if a society, a culture, an ideology says that about another large group. So, looking at conflict between nations, and although the words deep state are not mentioned this week, our speakers describe a nuclear machine out of control and offer a stark choice: either we finish it or it will finish us. We begin with the following recording, which is introduced by Maria Geladin of TUC Radio.
Thermonuclear monarchy, choosing between democracy and doom. Elaine Scarry is professor of aesthetics and general theory of value at Harvard. Her most recent book, Thermonuclear Monarchy, reminds us that one man, the President of the United States, has the power to end life for everyone else by setting off nuclear weapons. That's a possibility that remains very real even after the so-called end of the Cold War. Professor Scarry says that this deeply violates our constitutional rights, undermines the social contract, and is fundamentally at odds with the deliberative principles of democracy. And she offers a new line of arguments and strategy for the nuclear disarmament movement. Elaine Scarry illustrates her point most effectively by quoting Richard Nixon in 1974, when he was threatened with impeachment. Nixon told reporters, "I can go into my office and pick up the telephone, and in 25 minutes, 70 million people will be dead." End quote. At a time when the risk of nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia around the conflict in Ukraine comes to worldwide attention, the status of the nuclear weapons arsenals and the question of who has the power to set them off becomes an existential question for all. Noam Chomsky said about the book Thermonuclear Monarchy, quote, "That we have escaped disaster so far is a near miracle." Elaine Scarry's remarkable contribution should inspire us to abolish this colossal folly, end quote. Elaine Scarry spoke on January 11, 2015, at the Wellington Avenue Church in Chicago. Thanks to Dale Lehman for the recording.
My book, Thermonuclear Monarchy, is about the incompatibility between nuclear weapons and governance. I think if you ask people in the American public whether nuclear weapons are ungovernable, they would acknowledge that they're ungovernable in the sense that they're subject to accidents. Some of us right before today's meeting were talking about the accident of Minute Air Force Base, where for 36 hours, six nuclear bombs were left out in the public open on a plane without anyone realizing it. Some of you know the accident where a French submarine and a British submarine collided under the ocean, two nuclear submarines. So we acknowledge that nuclear weapons are ungovernable in that, like everything else in the world, they're subject to accidents, but with much greater consequences. People will also acknowledge that nuclear weapons are ungovernable in the sense that they're subject to hackers and to rogue states. And the most flagrant instance is perhaps the hacking of the Air Force plane, the F-35, which is a 90% digitized plane. In the year in which that happened, the federal government had suffered 18,000 acts of hacking. So this is not an isolated incident, although it's the only incident in which a plane designed for nuclear missiles had this experience. What the book Thermonuclear Monarchy argues is that there simply is no way to have a democracy and to have nuclear weapons. But rather than starting with my own book, I want to start by just a quick reminder of the physical consequences of nuclear weapons and the way in which nuclear weapons have eliminated from all people of the world the right of self-defense, because there is no way to defend yourself against them. The right of self-defense is the right underlying all other rights. It has also eliminated the right of mutual aid, our ability to assist one another in ways that I will elaborate. And when we eventually get to my book, you'll see that part of my emphasis is the fact that we do have the power to undo this. We just need to recognize it. One of the most extreme signs of the destructive capacity of nuclear weapons is the recent work done by physicists on nuclear winter, as recently as 2013, which shows that the early estimates from the 1980s, if anything, underestimated the effects of nuclear winter. That research shows that if only a tiny percent of the current world arsenal is used, not 1%, but 1/100 of 1%, 44 million people will die on the first day, and 1 billion people will die in the first month. The problem we have in understanding nuclear weapons is the problem of large numbers of people. People in public health point out that there's a difference between narrative compassion and statistical compassion. We're not always good at narrative compassion when we're asked to sympathize with one, two, or three people, but we're pretty good at it. We're not good at statistical compassion at all, so that if something involves the fate of tens of thousands of people, or as in the case of nuclear weapons, millions of people, we simply cannot get it at all. A colleague of mine who teaches at MIT told me that in a recent lecture to 200 students, a lecturer was using the names Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and realized that there were blank looks on the faces of these very intelligent, well-educated students, and stopped and said, "How many in this room know what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?" And only four people raised their hand. So there is an important reason to be aware of things of the past. But I'm going to, for a few minutes, be talking about targets of the future, because we can't undo the injuries that have happened in the past, whereas we absolutely can intervene and prevent the injuries that will happen in the future. And I should say that, as I think you probably know, of the 17,000 existing weapons in the world today, 16,000 of them are weapons owned by the United States and Russia. The Natural Resources Defense Council points out that these weapons and their targets are not a kind of description of possible use. They're a directive for how the weapons are supposed to be used. And in fact, for each target, there is a specific particular weapon that is already assigned to that target. So it's much more concrete than we ordinarily think of it as being. Probably some of you felt what I felt when President Clinton, changed the targeting on our submarines to open ocean targeting. Up until that moment, the longitude and latitude of various cities were in all the missiles. He changed it to open ocean targeting because there was a danger that hackers would set off the missiles and launch them to those cities. But notice that that did not happen because Congress demanded it, the executive demanded it, or the military demanded it, or that we demanded it. It happened because hackers made people afraid to have the longitude and latitude already programmed in. If just 3% of the U.S. arsenal is used against a city, 50 million people will die. So 3% of our arsenal will result in the death of 50 million people. 50 million is about 17,000 times the number of people who were killed on 9/11, which can help us to understand the level of grief or mourning there would be. As I think probably some of you know, Scotland's recent vote, in which 46% of the population voted in favor of separating from England, was based on the wish to eliminate the Trident submarines from the Clyde River. The whole United Kingdom nuclear arsenal consists of 4 Trident submarines, and they are stationed in the Clyde River in Scotland. And the people in Scotland look on it as a morally obscene situation and want the weapons to be taken out. That was not widely reported, or it would be paragraph 15, unless you were reading Joe's blog or you were reading reports from Scotland, or in my case, I read Navy news releases, and the Navy, the U.S. Navy, certainly knew what the Scottish vote was about. And had they separated, that movement wanted to write a constitution that would make it illegal to have nuclear weapons in their country. By the way, the Scottish youth vote went for separation on the basis of wanting to get the Tridents out. So today we say that young people aren't so aware of this, but a great feeling of hope comes from the fact that the youth in Scotland was very well aware of this. This is speaking about a country, the United Kingdom, that has 4 Trident submarines. The United States has 14 Ohio-class submarines, which is the equivalent of the UK Trident. Each of the 14 submarines has the equivalent of 4,000 Hiroshima blasts. That means that each of our 14 submarines has the ability to destroy a continent. The math of this can be hard to keep in mind, but here's a figure that's simple. The Earth has 7 continents. We have 14 Ohio-class submarines. People in the United States like to tell themselves that these nuclear weapons are a holdover from the Cold War. Nothing could be further from the truth. 8 of these 14 Ohio-class submarines were made after the opening of the Berlin Wall. So that means that 32,000 Hiroshima blasts were made after the opening of the Berlin Wall, and that's actually a higher level of blast power than the whole blast power of World War II, where 67 countries were involved in fighting one another. The United States, as you know, already has taken on the 12 new Ohio-class submarines. The first is slated to arrive in the year 2021, which is 6 years away, shortly after my niece Alana graduates. The last one will appear in 2035. And when I concentrate on the Ohio-class submarines, this is not because this is the worst part of our nuclear arsenal. In fact, our land-based nuclear weapons, the ICBMs, and the air delivery systems from the B-2s and the B-52s and the F-35s is actually higher blast power than our nuclear submarines. So the point of this first section of my talk is just to say that international law is designed to prevent this kind of injury. The Hague Convention, the Geneva Conventions, the St. Petersburg Declaration, conventions against genocide, all prohibit this kind of suffering. In 1995, 78 countries went to the International Court of Justice and asked the court to declare nuclear weapons illegal. The litigants included Islamic countries such as Qatar. It included countries that did not yet have nuclear weapons, like India and North Korea. And the various countries invoked the various international protocol, Hague, Geneva, and many other conventions, to beg the court to have these declared illegal. That, of course, included Japan, saying it was the only country against which they'd been used, and the Marshall Islands, all talking about the illegality of weapons which indiscriminately go across borders. Here are two things to know about this law case. The United States, in a joint statement made by the Department of Defense and the Department of State, argued that having nuclear weapons, threatening to use nuclear weapons, using nuclear weapons, and using nuclear weapons first does not violate Geneva, does not violate Hague, does not violate the St. Petersburg Declaration, does not violate the conventions against genocide. They acknowledged that millions of people would be killed, but they said the intent wouldn't be to eliminate a specific race or ethnic group. Does not violate the conventions on the ozone layer and the environment. The second thing to know is that this case was not reported in the United States, though the case went on for months. You will look in vain in the LexisNexis to find any report of it. At most, it occasionally turned up on page 15 of the newspapers. So law is an attempt to address the problem of statistical compassion. It says, it doesn't matter whether you like me or not. You're not allowed to injure me. It doesn't matter whether I hold the same religious faith or not. You're not allowed to injure me. And yet, if these international laws are not being followed, then the international law seems to just subside. Now, you often hear our fellow citizens and residents in the United States saying, well, they're here to stay. They can't be unmade. And for a few moments, I just want to emphasize the fact that, of course, they can be unmade. Some of you may know the very powerful article written by Bill Joy in the year 2000 in the magazine Wired magazine. Bill Joy wrote a very controversial article saying that one day it might happen that our robots are going to rebel against us. It sounds science fiction-y and crazy, until he points out that the prototype for this is nuclear weapons. Why? Because nuclear weapons can eliminate us, but we seem to feel that we can't eliminate them. And I want to just stress for a moment that there are many sources of evidence showing that they can be eliminated. Another report from Scotland by that same author, John Ainslie, called Disarming Trident, shows how long it would actually take UK to disarm their tridents. And he shows that it actually can be done very quickly. Some stages of it, dismantling the triggers, et cetera, take a matter of days or weeks, and other stages take months. But the overall timetable is something like 4 years. Admittedly, with a huge arsenal of the level we have, it would take much longer. But it certainly is doable. It's simply a matter of dismantling the weapons. Now, just think for a moment how much easier this is than global warming. I believe all of us should be working day and night to try and figure out how to stop global warming, but we don't quite know how to do it. With this, it's very straightforward how to do it. You dismantle all the weapons. The book that I've written, Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom, studies two provisions of the United States Constitution that are utterly incompatible with nuclear weapons. Now, you might say, given the fact that nuclear weapons cause this level of destruction, that they imperil the whole surface of the Earth, what does it matter that it also involves the tearing up of the Constitution? But the point of this is to say, we have the tools through which we can demand that these missiles and these weapons be disarmed. This Constitution is our Constitution, and it enables us to restore governance. These are not accidental features. These two clauses in the Constitution that I'll tell you about in a moment are not accidental features of the Constitution. They are the heart of what a Constitution is, and I show this by going back to the philosophic origins of social contract theory and the work of Locke and Thomas Hobbes and the way in which they designed the social contract as, more than anything else, a tool for preventing injury and for overseeing a country's entry into war. If nuclear weapons and constitutions are utterly incompatible, which is what this book argues, if they are starkly incompatible, then if you're going to have your constitution, you cannot have nuclear weapons. If instead you have nuclear weapons, you cannot have your constitution. We've chosen the second. Now, something else happens. If you put away that constitution, you begin to think that it's just a feeble, useless piece of paper. And so part of what we need to do is to remember what a powerful tool this is, and what it, if we simply pick it up off the ground and begin to use it, it enables us to do. So the first provision that oversees war making is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, the requirement that we never go to war unless we have a congressional declaration. Some of you might say, don't even talk to me about Congress. Congress is so foolish and ridiculous that I don't even want to see what they have to do. But that's circular. Congress has become foolish because it has lost its oversight over the declaration of war. And the timing of this is not accidental. At the very moment when nuclear weapons were invented, or atomic weapons were invented, we stopped having congressional declarations of war. We have not had a congressional declaration of war since World War II, that is, since the invention of atomic weapons. We had a shadow of one in the Persian Gulf War, but it was a conditional declaration, and in all earlier declarations, that was seen as an illegal form of a declaration. The chapter on this in this book takes the five cases where we've had a congressional declaration. That's the War of 1812, the War of 1846, the Mexican-American War, the War of 1898, the Spanish-American War, and World War I and World War II, and looks at the quality of deliberation that goes on in going to war and contrasts it with presidential decisions about using atomic weapons. And over here you see very high-level deliberation, and over here you see no deliberation, and I'll elaborate that in a minute. But I realize I forgot to tell you something. Many people in the United States, most of us, think that if a president is thinking about using nuclear weapons, we'll know about it. Our model is the Cuban Missile Crisis. The president was thinking about using it, and we knew about it. That is not the model. We know now of at least 10 instances when presidents came very close to using nuclear weapons. Eisenhower administration, 1954, Taiwan Straits. Eisenhower administration, 1959, Berlin crisis. Three times during the Kennedy administration, Robert McNamara has told us that three times we came within a hairbreadth of all-out nuclear war. And he was the Secretary of State under Kennedy. President Johnson has said that he considered dropping them on China to prevent China from getting a nuclear weapon. Nixon has said he considered using them four times. What does he mean by considered? Well, in one of the instances, he actually sent 18 B-52 bombers loaded with nuclear weapons towards Vietnam over Russia. He meant it as a bluff, but bluffs that involve nuclear weapons are very perilous things to indulge in. All those instances are many decades ago because we only find out about them 30 or 40 years after they happen, when the presidential papers are released. The ones that are happening right now, we don't hear about. And I can give you examples of things that might make us wonder what our presidents are doing. So just a quick contrast between the congressional deliberation and the presidential deliberation. There are crucial features that they distinguish them. In the congressional deliberation, the members of Congress understand what they're voting on. There's a set of sentences. Be it hereby enacted that Congress assembled does hereby declare war. Everybody understands that's what the deliberation's about. In the Eisenhower papers, in the 1954 Taiwan Straits crisis and the 1959 Berlin crisis, there's no set of sentences on the table. There's just a mishmash of discussion that involves the word dropping an atomic bomb. In the Congress case, people have individual responsibility. After the deliberation, each person has to come up and say his or her name and give a vote, yes or no, and they will be on the record forever, as Janet Rankin is on the record forever as voting no against World War II, as are all the yes votes. There's no such vote in the presidential deliberation. Maybe most important, there's no dissent in the presidential deliberation. In the case of Congress, you have people dismantling one another's arguments, and that tests the arguments. Only if the arguments for going to war, only if the arguments that this country is the enemy can stand up against these counterarguments, will we actually go to war. And believe it or not, Congress makes very good arguments. It's in recent decades been infantilized so that everybody has given up on Congress, but that's in part because it's given up this power to oversee our entry into war. What do we find in the Eisenhower papers? Here's the closest thing to a moment of dissent or testing that I could find in the 1954 Taiwan Straits papers. Secretary of the Treasury Humphrey says, "Aren't we going to have a hard time explaining to the American people why islands with names they've never heard of, like Matsu, warranted dropping an atomic weapon?" Eisenhower says, "A mere look at the maps on the wall will persuade you of the strategic importance of these maps." Now, poor Secretary Humphrey, he had studied his notes from a meeting that had happened a couple of months earlier in which Eisenhower had said, "We might have a hard time explaining to the American people why islands they've never heard of were important enough for us to drop an atomic weapon." The important point to get, though, is that at the moment when Humphrey says that and Eisenhower reprimands him, no one else talks back. No one else says anything. End of story. And that follows from the nature of presidential councils. They are hierarchical. In that early moment, Eisenhower says, "I might be impeached if I do this because first use of nuclear weapons, of atomic weapons, is in violation of the constitutional requirement for a declaration of war." By 1959, he has decided that if he just invites a few congressmen to his White House meetings, maybe that will kind of count as a congressional deliberation. So there are a number of senators and representatives there. And one of them, a man whose name will be familiar to you, Senator Fulbright, says in the midst of the conversation, "Wait a minute, I just want to make sure I understand what's being said here. Are we saying that East Germany might destroy the Autobahn routes in West Berlin and that we might have a repair company start to rebuild those and that an East German soldier might fire a rifle at the repairman and then we would drop an atomic bomb?" Eisenhower says, "Well, we aren't exactly sure of the steps that would lead up to the dropping of the atomic bomb, but we know for sure that there won't be time to think it through once it starts happening." So Fulbright doesn't say, nor does anyone else say there, have you gone mad? Are we really going to massacre the East German people because somebody fires a rifle? But instead, the meeting goes calmly on. I believe that if Congress reacquires its responsibility for overseeing our entry into war, that it will regain the stature that it had in earlier periods. The second provision of the Constitution that tries to provide a kind of impediment in the way of going to war. It doesn't mean we can't go to war, but it puts an impediment, a testing, in the way of it, is the right to bear arms. Now, this is a more controversial argument in my book, as in the case of the requirement for a congressional declaration of war, a very long chapter is devoted to showing the truth of this. Today, the country is divided between people who just love guns and think that the right to bear arms is there to ensure their right to carry guns for hunting and to protect themselves against criminals, and those people in more liberal circles and universities who don't even want to hear the words right to bear arms. And in fact, the Second Amendment is really conforms to neither of these two views. The Second Amendment is a very great amendment, and what it is designed to do is to make sure that there is distributed to the whole country responsibility to oversee the country's collective injuring power. It doesn't say how much injuring power we have. We might have a lot, we might have none at all. It's anterior to that. It says however much we have, it's going to be equally divided between all of us. And the reason for that is that the only way to hold military power in a civil frame is to cut it up into small pieces and to make sure that it's being looked at by each person, as tends to happen when there is a draft. So this is obviously something that it would take a long time for me to spell out in detail, but there's a couple of key points that I should make. First of all, as in the case with the Congressional Declaration, where it means that before we invade a country, and by the way, I should say that presidents have come to feel that if they have the power to annihilate another country, why should they have to bother to get Congressional Declaration merely if they're going to invade former Yugoslavia or invade Haiti or Panama or Afghanistan? In fact, the elder Bush said, I didn't have to get permission from some old goat in Congress to go into Kuwait and kick Saddam Hussein out of there. The Constitution requires that you put 535 layers of intervening humanity between the thought of going into war and the actual doing of it. The right to bear arms includes many, many more intervening layers of possibly resistant humanity. If you imagined it to be the whole American adult population, it would be 250 million people. If you said, well, in 17th and 18th century wars, there was only 3% of the population involved, that would still be 9 million people who would be debating it and talking about it, instead of what we have today, which is, with the exception of people in peace action and equivalent groups, no discussion when we go into war, merely turning on the TV to see what our country, namely what the president and the military, are going to do, instead of all of us taking responsibility for assessing it and seeing whether we ought to be doing it. The second point to make is people often say soldiers are mindless automatons who follow orders. Nothing could be further from the truth. I've studied many, many different wars, and in all of them you see examples of the fact that countries only go to war if the soldiers consent to it, and they often dissent. We, of course, all know this from Vietnam. And that dissent not only happened at the threshold, it happened at the interior. For example, in 1 year alone, in 1971, 33,000 soldiers, American soldiers, deserted from Vietnam. In Iraq, in the recent war in Iraq, in 2004, in 1 year, 2,300 soldiers deserted. In the first 6 months of 2007, 5,000 people deserted, and the Department of State took the numbers off their website so you could no longer follow them. But what we're seeing there is true of every war. For example, in the Civil War, a wonderful scholar from the 1920s, Ella Lawn, has shown that there were desertions on both sides, North and South. But as the war was going on, more and more people were deserting from the South, until in the end, 250,000 Southern soldiers deserted. And that's how we won, in part, how we won the Civil War. I quote in the book all these reports issued by Robert E. Lee, where he essentially is reporting, I looked behind me and there was no one there. 100 people deserted today, 250 people deserted today, 35 people deserted today. Soldiers are not automatons, they are not drones who simply carry out an execution that they're ordered to do. They think, they test. I could go on and on citing examples. At the end of World War I, for example, Winston Churchill wanted to take the soldiers into Russia to stand with the whites against the Reds. He writes to Lloyd George, I couldn't do it. The soldiers wouldn't let me. There were soldier strikes in 19 different cities in England, and also in Canada, and also in India, and elsewhere among British soldiers saying, enough, we aren't going to do this anymore. So I'm not trying to paint a portrait of soldiers as always dissenters. I'm saying that when they consent, when the country goes to war, it's because the soldiers have been convinced of the need to do that. And this is something that generals always acknowledge. For example, Napoleon said, moral factors are to physical factors by a ratio of 4-1. Moral factors are the consent of the soldier. Montgomery, a general during World War II, said, in war, morale of the soldiers isn't one factor, it's the only factor. So they know very well that they have to work hard to persuade the soldiers to go. And then the next point that I would quickly make is that civil stature follows from military stature in the United States and elsewhere as well. Here's a couple of quick examples of that. The 15th Amendment, extending the right to vote to African Americans, was argued primarily on the basis that 180,000 blacks had fought in the Civil War and couldn't be deprived of the right to vote. The 19th Amendment, giving the right to vote to women, was almost as strongly linked to the right of self-defense. It said that women can defend themselves and they can also help in the defense of their country. There were many suffrage pageant plays and ceremonies that showed that. Most recently, the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age from 21 to 18, was argued on the basis that both the soldiers who fought in Vietnam and the college students who fought on university campuses against that war had earned for themselves and future generations the right to vote at a younger age. That's wording from the congressional debate on this issue. And people from both liberal and conservative sides said this is the most civically sophisticated generation we've ever had. They deserve to vote at a younger age and to have all people coming along voting at a younger age. So if we've now all lost military rights, we have no military say, then we've also lost civic stature, even if we don't realize it. Now, we want to have time for a discussion, so I want to stop shortly, but I just want to say that that's the first third of the book, what I've just said to you about the two constitutional provisions. But the book goes on from there to talk about social contract theory. And just as the existence of nuclear weapons has made our Constitution look like something that we might or might not choose to follow, so too, nuclear weapons have distorted social contract theory to such an extent that Thomas Hobbes is often cited as though he would approve of nuclear weapons. He has been made the kind of a spokesman or the figurehead for a neo-realist school of international conflict that allows the leader of each state to determine what's going to happen to the fate of everyone else in the world. And this is simply about as far from what Thomas Hobbes is. So later chapters try to show that for Thomas Hobbes, as for Locke, the social contract is a contract for peace. That's why constitutions all over the world have the word peace either in the prelude or in the one of the early articles of the Constitution. And that he actually, as with our own U.S. Constitution, sees both the assembly, the parliament, and the individual soldier as the break on going to war. It doesn't mean you can't go to war. It just means it has to be tested before you do. I think I'll stop there, except to say that two things. First, only injuries that haven't yet happened can be stopped. And we do have the power to stop them. If thousands of people turned out and helped President Obama dismantle these things, that could happen. And I believe that people of all faiths and all races can work together on this. And that reminds me to tell you that a book has just come out called African Americans Against the Bomb. that is, I think, a very important book that shows that African Americans have been in the forefront since 1945 in opposing nuclear weapons for reasons that I can summarize for you if we have time during the discussion period. And then the second thing to say is that, again, the time to try and undo this is before it happens, not after it happens. John Locke quotes a passage from an earlier writer that says that Caligula, a tyrant from history, Caligula had but one wish, and that was that the whole population had a single neck so he could dispatch them at a single blow. Nuclear weapons have literalized that. We have presidential first use policy, and presidents and other leaders in the nuclear states can dispatch the whole world's people, as well as snowy owls and flowers and ponderoso pine trees and everything we love, in a single blow. And it's our responsibility to try and undo that. Thank you for listening.
And the speech is followed by a short Q&A.
So his first question, and tell me if I don't have this right, is it really the case that after carrying out a revolution in which it had been hard to raise sufficient armies, that our fathers literally tried to encumber the process of going to war in the Constitution they wrote? That's question one. Question two is about right to bear arms. So the answer to the first question is yes, absolutely. And here's what's interesting. When the Constitution was written, the assembly that was deciding on the form of the Constitution decided that in going to war, it had to be the biggest body within the federal government that oversaw our entry into war. They explicitly debated, should it be the president acting alone? Should it be just the Senate? And they explicitly said, no, it has to be the biggest body, the legislative body. And they said that, in fact, you could have a smaller body arranging for peace. The Senate alone can do that. But you need to have the biggest body doing the overseeing the entry into war. When Justice Joseph Story in the 19th century reviewed that provision, he said, now you can argue that in going to war, it's an emergency. We need to act fast. Therefore, why involve all these people? But the answer, he said, is that thousands of people are going to die. The blood and treasure of the country is going to be spent. Often the result of war is that one of the two countries ceases to exist. Therefore, he said, it ought to be very difficult to get into war, and you ought to have every branch of government involved in it. Now, Madison, going back to the earlier moment, said it would not be unreasonable to even ask for not just a majority vote, but a two-thirds vote of each house because of the importance of this. Now, here's the interesting thing. The original Constitution did not have any of the first 10 amendments. Most of us, if we were asked what's important about the Constitution, would say First Amendment, right of assembly, right of free speech, right of religion, Second Amendment, Fourth Amendment, trial provisions, etc. The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, did not come about at the Federal Assembly. They came about as a result of the ratification process in which the Constitution went out to the states, and the states debated whether they were going to pass the Constitution. And a number of states said, we're only going to do this if it's assumed that we'll get amendments, one of which was the right to bear arms. So Madison agreed. They would rather than starting all over, rewriting the Constitution, they would put in the amendments. So, interestingly, you have the Assembly saying, who gets to decide going into war? The largest possible part of the government, the full Assembly. Then it goes out to the people, the United States, the states, and they say, who gets to decide about going to war? The people. Each of them takes the largest possible unit and says, it has to be there in going to war. Madison felt, on the basis of the right to bear arms, why do you even need to spell that out in the Constitution? After all, and this would be true if we only had conventional weapons, let's say we only had rifles. Now follow Hamilton and Madison's thinking on this, and I think I have the quotes here because the quotes are so wonderful that I ought to give them to you. Both of them say, why do you need to write this out? The fact that you have to call out your citizens to help you in a war means that you can't possibly go forward without their authorization. So why do you even have to write an amendment that says that? And let me just give you Hamilton's saying, what he says. Is it probable that such a conspiracy between the legislature and the executive to permit such a menace would exist at all? That is, to do something that the people didn't want? Is it probable that it would be persevered in and transmitted along through all the successive variations in a representative body? Is it presumable? Can it be supposed that there would not be found one man discerning enough to detect so atrocious a conspiracy, or bold or honest enough? Madison goes even further. What he says in Federalist number 46 is that the idea of imagining an executive with a fixed plan for the extension of the military establishment, that the government and the people of the state should silently and patiently behold the gathering storm and continue to supply the materials until it should be prepared to burst on their own heads, is preposterous. And yet, what we have is a gathering of materials ready to burst over our own heads without our being able to say anything, because we're not required to carry the guns onto the battlefield, and therefore we don't have to be given the reasons why we're going to war against those people. In fact, we don't even know, as in the case of 9 of the 10 instances in which we've almost used nuclear weapons, we don't even know about them. You know, I alluded to the fact that there may be things in our own period. There are certainly times in our own period where presidents consider using them. And I'll just give you one example. On 9/11, President Bush, you remember, flew around in Air Force One, which is fine. Of course he should do that. He could well assume Washington and the White House is a target. Where did he stop? Off at Air Force Base in Nebraska. Off at Air Force Base, prior to 9/11, was in every newspaper account of it, described as the nerve center of our nuclear force. And furthermore, of our nuclear force, not only against states, but against terrorists. Now, stop and think, what does it mean, a nuclear retaliation against a terrorist? You have 5 or 18 or 30 men who decide to do some terrible piece of destruction on a country, and now we're going to take a nuclear weapon and injure millions of people? Did anyone bring this up when he stopped it off at Air Force Base? Did the 9/11 Commission report say, why did they stop it off at Air Force Base? Yes, they asked why it was, and they decided it was because they had enough facilities there to accommodate all the people on Air Force One. Do you think that every Air Force Base in the United States didn't have beds enough for everyone on Air Force One? No, of course they did. Now, your second question was, in this terrible situation we're in with arms in this country, where I think, if I understand you correctly, where arms are being used to harm people, am I understanding you correctly? How can we possibly hope that the right to bear arms could ever be benignly used to prevent or to even give us all a say about whether we go into Afghanistan, Syria, Iran, etc.? And here's the answer to that. Again, I'm not talking about actually distributing arms. We could debate that, whether you have to actually distribute the arms. What I'm talking about is distributing authorization over the arms. Gandhi, who we all know is a pacifist, said, of all the evil committed by England against India, the worst is the disarming of the population. Give us back our arms, and then we'll tell you whether we're going to use them. And of course, his argument was, we're not going to use them. But you don't even have the power to say that unless you actually have some authority over the military power of the country. Right now, the only people who are taken seriously on military weapons are people who have actually themselves been in missile silos, like Bruce Blair, or who have been former secretaries of defense, or people like Robert McNamara, who says nuclear weapons are illegal, immoral, dreadfully dangerous, and have to be eliminated right away in our own country. And those people are listened to, and they should be listened to, and I thank goodness for their existence every day. But the ordinary population is treated dismissively as peaceniks or hippies or people who, what's sometimes called in the media, ban the bombers, as though human beings don't have what in Switzerland is called equality of survival. We all have an equal right to wish to survive, and we all have an equal responsibility for making sure that human beings and all creatures on Earth survive. So it can't be that only people who have the power to fire the missiles also, once they retire, have the power to say, by the way, folks, these should be eliminated tomorrow, which is what a lot of retired military and defense people do say. Again, let me just say something I said that I think you missed. It doesn't mean we have to distribute arms. It means we have to distribute authorization over arms. It's not at all a matter of saying, let's each get a gun by any means. Now, when you say that they didn't debate individuals and they didn't say resist the government, that is entirely incorrect. And the chapter is loaded with examples, not at the Federal Assembly, but during the ratification debates and in the pamphlets that are going on. The pamphleteering, they are absolutely saying that individuals have to have arms. They even talk about what the kind of arms are. They even talk about the importance of having them be uniform arms across the whole population. They talk about the fact that the dangers from your own central government are possibly as bad as from a foreign invader, that there's no difference between being tyrannized over by your central government and a foreign government. They say that repeatedly. And if the military power is only held by the three of us and none of you, it may be that we're the nicest people in the world and you feel at ease. But Justice Brown in the 19th century said, no population has the right to assume that it will always have wise and generous leaders. That's why you have to have a rule of law and not a rule of men. You have to go by what the law says. And we have a policy of presidential first use. They are ready to go. They certainly have to be now guarded with everything every country has, absolutely. And there are lots of people working on different forms of verification so that that you could feel secure about it. Or some people have proposed that, you know, an international body would be in charge of protecting these, and you would have rotating countries overseeing that oversight. There are different arrangements. It's not as though there are ready-made answers to this. A lot of deliberation would be required, but being able to deliberate again would be a step forward rather than being just passively sitting there hoping no one uses it. Because if it were used, whether by a terrorist, a rogue state, or much more likely by a state, and I say much more likely simply because you have to go through thousands of steps to get this architecture ready. The nuclear arsenal is ready because the states have gone through the thousands of steps. The terrorists didn't go through a thousand steps to get it in place. It's there to be used and misused because of what we did. And we ought to take the steps to dismantle it.
And while we're on the subject of dismantling things, I would say I can't see nuclear weapons getting dismantled without massive public awakening, not only to the perils of nuclear weapons, but the control by the deep state of the commercial media, of the democratic processes, false flag attacks. I think it is all coming out in fairly short order, to be honest, and there's no time in this show for me to go into more details on what I see to be the eventual fate of the money system. But yes, it is connected to the collapse of social power that Ivan Illich hinted at, which I explored in greater detail in episode 523. Now, you may wish to keep in your mind that just as nuclear power and nuclear weapons are more or less inseparable, so the modern money system and the control of huge numbers of people by small numbers of people, again, it's the same topic. And without that, it seems to me highly implausible that any of this nuclear shenanigans would have got very far, because it doesn't seem to me that a lot of people actually want it. It springs from the fear-based mindset of control, some of the perils of which we examined in our last episode. The remainder of the show is three recordings from the third session of the first day of a symposium on the dynamics of possible nuclear extinction that was organized by Helen Caldicott. Our first speaker, academic Greg Mello, is executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, and he is speaking on the role and funding of the U.S. nuclear weapons labs.
Lewis Mumford remarked in the 1950s that about the scientist movement, that even though the scientists who developed the bomb were very concerned about its effects, they remained in their laboratories, they remained in their universities, and we're fortunate to have some exceptions to this ivory tower mentality here with us today, but I think we have to challenge ourselves and challenge others to leave business as usual in our own lives in order to foment and inspire others. Mumford said that the scientist movement in the late 1940s and 1950s wasn't fruitful because the scientists stayed in their laboratories. That was the fundamental problem with it. There was nothing wrong with the content of what they said. It was that they stayed in the labs. So this brings us to the labs, which are a small but important part of this problem of human survival. The quotes that I've put on the cover here are from some practitioners from the inside that are remarking on changes that have occurred in the nuclear weapons laboratories in the relatively recent time. And you can read those yourself, I think. Bob Puerfoy is a very important person, extensively quoted recently in Command and Control by Eric Schlosser, and has been an activist in his retirement. The transition from public service to private enterprise and greed, as a previous generation might have called it, is both a tremendous danger, but it is also part of the opportunity that we have, because a weapons complex founded on greed and corporate profit is not a very functional weapons complex. I wanted to say something that we could skip over, that nuclear extinction is going to begin somewhere, and usually the way people think about it is it's not us. It's not human beings, it's some other species far away, or it's some people far away. And I think that we have to fight against a politics of disposability wherever we find it. And the key triage that I think that we have to be concerned about is the triage of our time and attention. I also wanted to emphasize that we don't know what will happen when a nuclear detonation occurs. I was in Vienna at two conferences about the humanitarian impacts of nuclear weapons, and I felt there was a systematic understatement of the humanitarian impacts of nuclear weapons at those conferences, despite every attempt to incorporate the effects of nuclear weapons. We've heard today references to this inchoate, unknowable post-nuclear reality. But just because we can't predict it and don't know it doesn't mean that it's not important. How well will we cope with any major problem of the world if there is a single nuclear weapon detonated anywhere? What kind of polity, what kind of response will we have to any of the other major problems that we face? And I wanted to say, since it hasn't been emphasized quite enough yet, that we face nuclear extinction from the sun. And this we face because of business as usual. Even if we avoid nuclear extinction by nuclear war, if we continue with our present way of life, with our present capitalist structure, with our present effort to dominate, with our present resource extraction,